We all know that loyalty programs have been the bedrock of the travel industry for decades. Airlines originally started out using these and issuing miles so that customers would continue traveling on their planes, even when their schedules were a little bit different. Now that's evolved over the last 10, 15, 20 years to now being the single source of profit in a lot of cases for airlines. It's also created an entirely new consumer segment where airlines are selling these miles to credit card companies, and credit card companies are able to capture significant spend from consumers by issuing these points, miles, and other benefits. I wanted to dive in more on how this is all working. With everything that's changed post-pandemic, are these and all these different strategies that airlines are introducing in order to incentivize spend, what's working, what's not working, and what does the future hold? So I brought in Gary Leff, founder and author of View from the Wing, to discuss more and find out if Crow knows loyalty. You feel alive, let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, my break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, y'all got the semi-fold weight. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and tried to locate. This for the time, got time for no day war. Welcome to another edition of the Crow Knows podcast. I'm joined by Gary Leff, founder and author of View from the Wing. Gary, how are you doing?
I am always great.
Good. I love it. This is exciting for me. Like I mentioned, I'm a longtime reader of yours and have always appreciated your perspective on not only just the points and miles game, but the business behind it and how businesses are, you know, kind of the cause and effect of how this usually goes rather than just, hey, what can we get for our points and miles? Give the listeners a little bit of a background on how you got into this business.
Yeah, so I was just a frequent business traveler out of college. I mean, dating way back, I was a pretty frequent flyer even as a 5 and 6 year old. Right? So, yeah, parents divorced, lived in a different side of the country, flying back and forth. That was even before the miles game began. But you know, I'd be flying and I would always look at that like first class cabin. I'd never imagine that I'd be one of those people up there. I mean, it always seemed like, I'd never spend that kind of money. You know, how could it be worth it? You know, never occurred to me that there'd be these, you know, paths, up there to get it, you know, at a discount or for free. And, but you know, as I kept traveling, I used to just read all the fine print of everything that got sent to me. And you know, after college, I'm traveling a lot for work. I'm traveling, you know, initially just several times a month, eventually, you know, pretty much like weekly. And I'm getting all the frequent flyer stuff in the mail. And I'm reading it back when it was, you know, physical paper stuff and realizing that there was a pretty good value proposition back in the day. And I said, okay, they have these partnerships. And if you go to you know, 3 restaurants that participate and you get these bonus points, and you know, but it doesn't say anything about a minimum spending at any of the restaurants. And so I just go into the, you know, the place and get a soda and wait and see if the miles post. Wow, that was pretty good. You know, I start accumulating these points and, you know, use it initially just to, you know, fly cross country, fly to see my family in Australia, and being able to do that in business class rather than in economy, like when I was a teenager, just was, it was incredible. Or in status, getting upgrades. And then once you start doing that, you don't want to be in back and you pay more attention. And I'd start getting, realizing that my own behavior was being shifted by the program. So I've got a meal that I can pick up for work and expense. And I want to make sure that it's at the restaurant that earns 10 points per dollar, right? You know, so I'm really leveraging it. I'm always trying to grab the check, you know, and everyone's eating out together and I'll take the cash, but then I got to make sure that I'm actually getting everyone's cash, right? Nobody's shorting me. And, you know, that was just way back in the day. And thinking back to, you know, 22 years ago, I was living in D.C. I lived in D.C. area for 18 years. All my friends began writing political blogs. I realized, you know, I mean, I've got opinions, I have opinions, but I didn't have anything unique to say in that space that, you know, nobody was saying. And so I said, well, one weekend, I'm just going to spin up something and write about what everyone always asks me questions about, which is about, you know, travel and product and loyalty. And so I just started writing about it back when, you know, nobody was reading it. But over the course of 22 years, and for whatever reason, you know, people started reading. And I still write. I mean, I write it all myself. Over the course of those couple decades, I've had, you know, maybe 8 or 10 things that have gone up, you know, from other people where they've shared some things where there was a unique perspective to offer, you know, that, you know, that felt like adding something. But, you know, I'm writing six things a day for 20 years. So, you know, it's just all me. And I write like nobody's reading, right? Still like in the old days, forgetting, you know, until my, you know, cell phone rings, getting yelled at because, you know, some, you know, top executive is like angry. But I just like say what I think and I don't pull punches and I just, you know, offer my perspective.
It's always been, again, as a longtime reader and follower of yours, it's always a very measured kind of analytical perspective on it, which I always appreciate. And your background, because you're CFO by trade, right?
Yeah. And a background in economics. So, you know, and having had the great fortune of being in a room with people much smarter than I am for, you know, many, many, many years. And, you know, professionally, I've, you know, been able to interact with, you know, six Nobel laureates in economics, you know, over time, and just, you know, always being, you know, the least intelligent person in a given room. I just am always learning a lot and, you know, just drinking from a fire hose and trying to, you know, take, and I read a lot, and I take in a lot of information and try to distill that in ways that's useful to folks who read me.
And I love it. It's always entertaining and always informative. And you do such a great job of distilling it down in a really simple way. And, you know, ultimately I want to get into kind of how businesses should be thinking about loyalty programs. But before we do that, I did want to just set the stage a little bit for when most people think about loyalty programs. Obviously, like you mentioned, they think of airlines, hotels, and credit cards as being the big keys. I think a lot of people don't understand ultimately how the actual business of a loyalty program works, right? Where airlines and hotels actually make the money. How do these companies benefit from the points? You know, how do they ultimately financially make money off of this? So if you can just set the stage a little bit for how the airlines, hotels, and credit card companies approach loyalty programs and what their motivation is for having those programs.
Yeah, so they're a little bit different in each of these cases, but, you know, so if you take a credit card company, very simply, right, they're going to be earning in a number of ways. They're going to earn, you know, an interchange fee when you swipe your card and you buy something. They're going to potentially earn from fees from the customer, and they're going to earn interest if you revolve, if you're not paying off your bill every month. And so there's a value proposition of acquiring a customer that spends money on the card. And they will give back, rebate some value to the customer as an enticement to use that product, right? So they will give you rewards, call it, you know, 1-2% cash back, call it points in another program. But they're basically just, you know, giving back some of the value they expect to earn. Now, they're not going to make money on every customer, especially because it costs money to acquire a customer. So, you know, that going out and acquiring the customer, they may give you the 70,000 points. And their model might say, you know, look, we're going to make a little bit every year on a certain percentage of these customers. And overall, that's going to cover the cost of acquiring those customers, maybe in, you know, 7 years, 8 years. It's a long payback period because it's a very competitive space. One of the ways that those credit card companies goes out and acquires customers is, you know, not just to offer a rich rewards value proposition of their own, but to go after the customers that are loyal to a specific brand. And that's where you get your co-brand credit cards, your, you know, airline or your hotel credit cards. So I want the frequent flyers of American Airlines who really value those American Airlines miles, but also some American Airlines benefits. So the credit card company is going to pay American, you know, for those miles and for those benefits. Now, if you look at the economics of what does American, you know, have in this, you know, it began where these were programs that were meant to get consumers to prefer the brand over another airline. So it's just marketing spend, right? And back in the day, it may have been, look, you know, we want you to wait a couple hours and take our flight instead of the one that you would have otherwise taken. And we're going to give you, you know, think of it as a sandwich shop punch card. And, you know, buy 10, you get your 10th sandwich free. And that was kind of the original model. And what they realized is these things were so much more successful than they ever imagined. People love travel. And, you know, in 1985, Continental Airlines and, you know, Marine Midland Bank issued the first airline co-brand credit card, and the bank buying those miles to give to the customer to encourage the spend on the credit card. And the airline was selling those miles for more than the mile cost. Well, why is it more than the mile cost? Because, you know, what an airline, first of all, it's their currency. They control how valuable it is at a given time, but they also have these seats that are going unsold occasionally, right? And once the plane takes off, that particular seat can never be sold. So the marginal cost to them of filling an otherwise empty seat is really, really low. I mean, some incremental fuel because of the extra weight of a passenger, you know, some, you know, less now that everything's electronic, but these have to print a ticket, maybe even mail the ticket. But it's a very low marginal cost. But it's something that people value at much higher than the cost to produce, because to go buy that ticket might be hundreds of dollars. So spoiling inventory was a huge opportunity. And the loyalty program also became the single largest buyer of travel from the airline. So you've got this like bulk discount, you know, spoiling inventory, an ability to, you know, offload that inventory, right, in an opaque way, so you don't undercut your pricing, right, and sell it cheap. And so they're selling these points to the bank for more than it costs them. They're making a return. You know, interestingly, you know, when an airline sells awards miles for flying, yeah, they are governed by accounting rules that say, look, the sale cost of the ticket has to be broken up into the current travel and the future travel. And roughly speaking, they will book about a penny per mile awarded in terms of the future travel liability. The economics are actually different. So the accounting rules are actually different for selling a mile to banks, because you can split it. It's not all internal to you. And so you get to split up how you want to allocate this money between renting of your database, renting of your brand, benefits like free check bags or priority boarding. And it's a much smaller future travel liability that they book. So they book a lot more in that revenue up front. Hotels being a little bit different, because the hotel chain, for the most part, doesn't own the hotels. And so they're taking in this revenue and they're paying out for the free nights to the hotels. And that piece of it, you know, earning at the hotels and paying out, is supposed to be more or less, you know, revenue neutral for the chain. They make a little bit more on the co-brand deals, but it's not quite as lucrative. It's still valuable. But if you look at the major airlines, I mean, American Airlines, basically all of their profit is selling miles to banks. Like, actually, like moving people on airplanes doesn't make money on its own. Now, it doesn't say that they ought to just go into the miles business and forget moving planes, because like nobody would want their miles then. You know, if you didn't have the planes to redeem them on, if you didn't have the airline partnerships. So, but if you look at the actual cost to, you know, staff and move an airplane and the revenue they generate, they're at best breaking even. Sometimes they lose. But the profits are really coming from, you know, from this loyalty game. Does that give you as a start?
And that's super helpful. And I think most people don't understand necessarily the why behind the loyalty programs and how they're really making money, and why, you know, a lot of times people are just confused. Oh, hey, well, why do, you know, how could I get this much value out of these points and just for these simple things, and what's really in it for everybody? And so that's super helpful. The landscape obviously has changed dramatically in basically every facet of mileage redemption and issuance, from how miles are accrued, going from like on airlines distance based versus, you know, mileage based versus now pretty much everybody's revenue based. And it also seems like over the last few years, those sign up bonuses have gone nuts. I mean, it used to be the 70,000 or 80,000 or 100,000 was very infrequent, but it seems like credit cards are getting more and more competitive with what they're issuing. Talk to us a little bit about what you've seen and kind of the why behind, or what's caused that huge explosion in the, you know, in the points issuance.
Yeah. So there's a few things going on now. Obviously at the very beginning, you were earning points for travel, and it was a limited number of points, and the value of those points was actually higher. It didn't cost as many for a free trip. And so we've seen inflation in the points earning and in the redemption costs, the earning from, you know, credit card spend that continues to grow. And we're talking about, you know, 2/3 of 1% of GDP going through just the Delta Airlines credit card. And it's not far behind that with United and with, you know, with American, between the three of them, probably at 2% of GDP on these three airline credit cards alone. And so that's generating a whole lot of miles, and you have more miles chasing a limited number of seats that kind of raises the price. You're also, and they're printing more miles with Accelerate. You used to earn only like 1 mile per dollar spent. Now you're often earning, 3 points on travel, maybe 3 points on dining, maybe bonuses on groceries. You might earn 2 points per dollar on everything. More earn in higher redemption prices. And it's, again, not just from air. It's also the case that airlines fill their planes a lot more than they used to. So there's a whole lot less boiling inventory that costs them very little, but they have to satisfy customers who want to use their points. And so they've shifted to a model on the redemption side where, they are trading off with potential ticket sales. So it's not just here's the seat that's going to go empty, and here's the saver award. You're bidding for seats that might get sold to a customer for cash, and you're bidding with with miles that have some value, potentially a low value per mile. But since you're competing for cash tickets, that's driving up the redemption cost. Now, attracting consumers, that marketing of credit cards and those initial bonuses, so they really began to rise substantially in earnest during the Great Recession, during the financial crisis. So what happened back then is airlines looked to their loyalty programs for cash, and they have these credit card partners. And these partners did deals that lent them money against the future value of these programs. They pre-purchased miles essentially at a discount that they were going to give away. And with these cheap miles that they bought, they were spending, they were able to give away more to attract customers. And they were needing to do that because they had shed customers, and they had reduced credit lines during the financial crisis. And so they were limiting that funnel. You're always losing customers every year if you're a bank. Right, annual fee comes due. You're going to shed some customers, and so you've got to keep refilling the funnel just to stay even. But for a while, they were kind of like not refilling the funnel, and then they're shrinking their card member bases and they're shrinking their credit, and people are spending less because of recession. So they got really aggressive, and they had these cheap miles to do it with. So they started. That's when we started to see the first ever 100,000 mile bonus was a British Airways card from Chase in 2009. And that kind of raised the bar, and we started to see a lot more competition in that regard. And it became really competitive and really expensive. And one of the things that changed in the way some of these deals work is how those acquisition bonuses are paid for. When an airline credit card, the bank is not paying the same for miles earned from spending as those initial bonuses. And an airline really benefits from a new card member, because that card member is going to spend, and then therefore the bank's going to keep paying the airline more and over time. So the more acquisition happens, the better for both parties. And so usually there will be some kind of a cost sharing, or at least discount on those miles, maybe something closer to the airline's cost of the miles for the acquisition bonus. And that structural change helped pay more miles to keep up with and make the card really vocal. And frankly, it's just the only tool for the most part that banks have had to get consumers to pay attention to the card and say, look, maybe this card would be good for me, but I'm busy. I've got 100 things I'm paying attention to this week. Why do I need to do it right now? Well, this unprecedented limited time offer that if I don't jump on it now, I will lose out. And it's gotten more and more expensive. And so the payback period has gotten longer and longer. And so, some of these cards, don't always make money. They build the assumption into the model. And it has to do with how much is a given card member going to revolve. Because some of those better, more rewarding cards will rebate the entire value of the interchange to the customer. Right? So they're betting on some of this future return. It's gotten, and as we've seen fewer and fewer airlines, their consolidation, the negotiating leverage of the airlines is going up relative to the banks. And so they've negotiated richer and richer deals which is why we're talking, you know, I mean, Delta reported just shy of $7 billion in revenue from SkyMiles last year. And that was, you know, overwhelmingly substantial, you know, 90%, you know, from American Express.
So that's one thing I wanted to really drill down on. So the, obviously we've got fewer airline options of the last 20, 25 years. It's been consolidation. We've had very few airlines actually come into the fold, you know, Southwest being the only one that's of the major carriers. It's a little more unique than the others. No first class option, but they've got the companion pass. It seems like most changes are negative for travelers. And we've also had this very extreme shift in business travel.
Yeah.
What are the airlines feeling, or what are you seeing in how they're kind of making up that difference in business travel?
Okay, so there's a lot that goes into that. There has been a gradual devaluation of the program, although we've seen, as I've mentioned, more earning opportunities that offset the rising cost of redemptions. So it's easier to earn. Now, that what that does is the past, you know, the past miles earned become worth less. Which is why I always say what you want to do is you want to spend miles in the same period in which you earn them, rather than saving those miles for some future period. So for the inflation, you know, earn and burn are kind of the same value proposition. And so we have seen this, you know, degradation of some of the programs over time. Part of that is as the airlines have, you know, filled planes more, and they've just had to adjust their model in order to satisfy customers. And, you know, part of it is figuring out that they don't always need to be as generous and better at targeting, and that they can get consumers to shift their behavior without exposing them to significant costs in the same way. So they become less rewarding, but at the same time, there's still a lot of value there, and often a lot of value in some of the international programs in a way that you can leverage more than U.S. Airlines. You can play with some of those international carriers often through bank credit card programs whose points transfer to other programs, right? And get access to some of those foreign carriers. And, you know, one of the easiest upgrades in the world with points is from, you know, business class on Emirates to first class, right? Take a shower in the air, and it's like, you know, awesome, right? $700 bottles of wine, it's pretty good. But they have easy upgrades. And they partner with all the big bank programs. Air France partners with all the big bank programs too. They get access to U.S. credit card consumers, which are not nearly as lucrative in Europe because of capped interchange. So they don't make big money on their credit card deals in Europe, but they want access to those, that credit card money in the U.S. They partner with everyone that's got a transferable currency. And in fact, they've said that this year they expect that a majority of Air France KLM awards will be redeemed in the U.S., not with members in Europe. So it's over 50% here, which is like crazy, right? I mean, they've got this, but they are that successful, you know, with those bank programs where you can get, you know, in fact, one of the really great improvements out of a program in the last year comes from Air France KLM's Flying Blue, where they have actually reduced the cost of most of their awards. A business class ticket to Europe, between US to Europe, is generally now 50,000 points each way. So it's lower than it was. It's like a pretty good price. So, and their availability for Air France and KLM for their own members is, you know, is much better than offered to their partners like Delta. So, so you can find a lot of value in some of those bank transfer programs.
With more and more of these programs going to, or valuing or emphasizing credit card spend as a way to earn status, it's interesting, especially I'm in Dallas, and so American's king, obviously, here. And there's been a pretty gradual decrease in what having status means. And also because there's so many travelers, like you said, that are earning status and are able to, you know, get into that platinum pro, you know, all these guys that were lifetime platinums just keep getting, you know, bumped down and down and down and down. And so there's this almost this race, or kind of this hamster on the wheel thing, where people are putting, and I know they want to get people to put spend on credit cards as a way to earn status. But when you earn status, it really doesn't matter that much. There's some, you know, marginal benefits you can get, but how is it? I know that's relatively new, but what are you seeing so far for that specifically, where that kind of race of hamster on the wheel to spend more money to get status. But once you get status, you realize you're not really getting much out of it. Has there been any fall off in customers doing that when they realize that?
Yeah. So so first of all, there was a big reset with the pandemic because we don't have the traditional managed business travel in the same way that we did. You know, the Monday to Thursday weekly consultant travel doesn't exist in the same way. So if you are, even with companies that have returned to office, but that still have people not in every day, if people aren't in their office all the time, the consultants they're engaging don't need to be at the client site every single week, right, for the whole week. And so it was the people that would fly out Monday, fly back Thursday evening, week after week after week, like that travel hasn't recovered. There's still, business travel, and it is recovering in the sense, but not returned to trend by any sense. And so with a changing composition of customers and a flattening also across of when people fly. So because people have, in many cases, more flexible schedules of where they're working from, when people may work from home or have a kind of a hybrid work schedule, they may fly somewhere on, Wednesday and back on Monday. Right? It may not be a Thursday to Sunday or a Friday to Sunday weekend. You may combine, for years, travel industry talked about leisure, it's a horrible word. The idea of like blended travel, it now actually exists in the sense of if you go somewhere, maybe you take your family, right? And you're working during the day on Thursday and during the day on Friday while they're hanging out at the resort. And so people, it spreads out. It's not the same peaks and valleys. Saturday is still a light day for travel, but it's not the same, Thursday afternoon and Friday and Sunday, Monday morning or like peak. And then there's like nothing on Tuesday and Wednesday. That's all changed. So the changing of the customers and also opportunity for a lot more creativity and a recognition that people spending on the airline credit card is a whole lot higher margin than moving passengers on planes. So what do you want to reward? Do you want to reward the 52% margin revenue of the loyalty program or the 5% margin revenue of the flying? So like, which is actually like the most valuable? So there's been a shift. American went the farthest first. Well, I should actually say that pre-pandemic, Frontier Airlines was the first one to award a qualifying point per dollar spent on their credit card. Right? They were the original there. They had to come up with something because they don't have the ability to reward you with flat seats and all these things. So they were creative. And so American kind of picked up that idea, but also earning points for, from all of their, not all, but, many of their partnerships, online shopping, right? Card linked offers, rental cars, hotels, gas, et cetera, recognizing that these are high margin. And so the composition of who's earning status changes and how. Initially, there were a lot more low tier folks than before and a shift of who's earning top tier. But look, with planes full again and lots of ways to earn status, and also a huge monetization of the premium product. So when I began 20 years ago, 10% of first class seats domestically were filled with paying passengers. Right now, it's generally 3/4 of them. And so there's a lot fewer seats to go around for upgrades. And that's a lot of the reason why the value of status in many ways has declined. Upgrades are being kind of the pinnacle of the benefit being so much harder to come by because, it used to be, here's this high price of first class, you pay it, or it goes to an upgrade. And now it's often, look, here's an incremental amount of money you can spend off a ticket to buy it. If you don't, we're gonna inundate you with even more discounted offers between the time you purchased and travel to buy it. If you're in the United Airlines app, they might say, look, here's a flight between my home in Austin to Houston. We'll give it to you up front for $59. And oh, by the way, there's 27 people on the upgrade list who want it for free. You can jump them. Okay. So the value declines. I still think there's a lot of value in status, but in some ways it's different. It's better service. It's being higher on the upgrade list, not the upgrade, sorry, the standby list. During irregular operations, better treatment when things go wrong, and access just to confirmed extra legroom seats or exit row seats. And that has a lot of value. So often it's those mid-tier status that carries much of the benefit of status. So if you're not earning naturally top tier, kind of generating it from zero doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're right on the cusp, sure, push yourself over the line. But, you know, but striving for more for that mid-tier, I think makes a lot of sense now. If you say, look, I'm not going to get upgraded anyway.
Yeah, which is, I think it seems like most people, at least in my position, we've kind of kissed that dream goodbye of you earn status and then get, unless you're, like you mentioned, that Saturday morning Dallas to Tulsa flight, I could count on that, but that was about it.
Then there's some people who, I mean, it really depends on when you fly and what routes you fly. There are still good upgrade percentages out there. But look, you know, let's say last year I had been kind of an accidental concierge key member with American Advantage, and I got upgrades, but not always. And when I got them, I was often, you know, number one on the upgrade list for one seat at the gate. And that was even before they did the new pilot contract deal that says at the gate, if there's a deadheading pilot, they're number one on the upgrade list. So, like, I mean, and so what chance does an executive platinum have, which is what I am now? I figure, okay, I've got my exit row. If I really needed to be in first, I know I can buy it. And sometimes that first class is, you know, it's an extra $100 on a 3-hour flight. Maybe I'll, like, it's not an extra $1,000. So you know, make that choice.
Yeah. So the interesting thing that I think we've gotten to now is there's a little bit of just everyone's lower their expectations on what they're going to get out of status. They've promoted or given people a reason to spend on the cards that aren't rewarding on their own. You know, most of these co-branded cards, you're getting a dollar unless you're spending on American Travel, for instance. And people are more flexible in their overall travel. And also most credit cards are, you know, with any sort of annual fee, it's kind of table stakes to get group four boarding and, you know, free check bag and things like that. And so what has this done? Have you seen any trends or anything that you're seeing that this has done to consumer behavior overall for travel? Are people kind of moving away from their allegiance?
Well, there is a point at which they certainly will. There is some risk. And Delta Airlines got a scare in the last 6 months because Delta announced a bunch of changes to their loyalty program about a shift towards, you know, just qualifying dollars, not miles flown anymore at all, not segments, qualifying dollars, dollars only. You can earn dollars with their premium credit card spend. And they were also going to limit access to their clubs, even for the people buying the premium credit card so it's come with club access, unless you hit certain spend thresholds on the card. So they're really driving people to the card spend. And they were not giving anyone anything new. They were only taking away. There was such a tremendous amount of outrage, such a backlash against this, that they came out with a whole bunch of sweeping changes that were a rollback, that were in some cases, you know, more generous than before. And they said, look, we're still on the track that we were before, but it was a mistake to do it all at once. But, you know, they got a huge scare. It tells me they were seeing something. And I say, look, oh, people were still acquiring cards. Yeah, they were spending also a tremendous amount on acquisition bonuses at that time. Of course, yeah, people are taking the 100,000 miles you're offering. But I think they were also seeing cards being canceled, people walking away. And unquestionably, the consumer sentiment was, you know, that this is nuts. And so, you know, they've got to keep testing. What is the boundary at which they can push consumers, right, where they're no longer going to generate incremental revenue and they're actually going to lose money because of some of those changes? There is a point at which that happens. It'll be different for every program. Historically, Delta was always able to go much farther than any of the other carriers. And that has something to do with their brand and that they're marginally friendlier, and then the position in some of their hubs, especially the interior hubs, where, like, if you are in the Salt Lake City area, you know, called the Upper Midwest, you know, in Atlanta, like, you're stuck with Delta, and you're, you know, and so, like, consumers wouldn't defect. But so they had a higher threshold. They could make their miles worth less than anyone else, and it didn't hurt them revenue-wise. The way that historically it did hurt American and United when they devalued. So that Delta was even backing off, I think, was really telling. They reached maybe some kind of an inflection.
Where do you think we go from here? We're obviously at, you know, the couple major changes in how people are, or how these companies are awarding status. What do you think the next, you know, what other cards do they have left to play?
Well, look, I mean, no one else has gone quite as far as American in Everything Counts. Delta went, you know, all the way on some of its cards with Amex. United loosened things a little bit with Chase, but not nearly to the same extent. If you're looking to qualify by status for status based on actual flying, United's program is now cheaper to do it with than the others, right? If you're looking to qualify based on card spend and everything else, there's no question American is much better than the others. If you're looking for a more traditional style program, where you earn miles by flying and, you know, it's based on distance and not just spend, the Alaska Airlines program is great. And you no longer have to fly Alaska flights in order to earn that status. It can be oneworld flights, including American, and your status is recognized when you fly American. So those traditional passengers, you know, maybe on cheaper but not basic economy fares doing long distances, Alaska is a great program. But I mean, I certainly think that the direction continues to be recognizing what profitable activity is. When there was the shift from, so distance flown isn't really a metric that correlates with, you know, value, although it may correlate with wallet share, which is important and what you want to shift, what you can shift. But revenue isn't either, because there's something very fundamentally different with a $500 ticket between Los Angeles and San Francisco and a $500 ticket between Los Angeles and London, right? But they were rewarding those the same way. Like that doesn't make sense either. So they're, you know, this idea of, well, now we're measuring the value of the customer. Like, no, I mean, so now there's a gradual shift towards, you know, what is the value of a customer? And, you know, and so we're seeing that continued evolution that has taken, you know, in some sense, 20 years, right? Or, you know, look, the first true revenue-based program, I guess, was America West Flight Fund, you know, that ended when they, you know, 20 years ago when America West, you know, and U.S. Airways merged, and they kept dividend miles. You know, 20 years ago, 22 years ago, U.S. Airways tried to say only full fare tickets would even count towards status. And there was a huge backlash against that. There was a movement of customers who called themselves cockroaches. They wouldn't go away. Everyone hates them, right? But we're always there. And the airline finally relented. And, you know, so it's been this battle against the consumer gradually and shifting the model for, you know, for decades, and that continues.
I thought it was interesting with, and maybe this is a trend that airlines will start exploring, although it hasn't seemed to work out too well, but that when Delta made the investment in Wheels Up and there was some benefits, basically some reciprocal benefits with, or not Wheels Up.
Wheels Up.
Where you could get, you know, depending on how much you popped into your account, you could get Delta Medallion status on top of it. Are there any other situations like that, either that you've heard of or that have gone on, or even if you could just speak to how that's worked out for Delta so far, if anything?
Well, I mean, Wheels Up didn't work out so well, right? Yeah. And they were on the verge of going out of business, and Delta just injected some, you know, some additional capital and effectively took control of Wheels Up. I mean, they had turned their own private jet charter business over to Wheels Up in exchange for equity. And you know, I mean, nobody's made that model work really well at a, you know, at an inexpensive price. You know, look, you know, you've got your NetJets sort of model, which is expensive, okay? But the cheap subscription, you know, and one-off model, everyone says, look, you ought to be able to make it work. And nobody that you burn through, light on fire a ton of VC money, and nobody's made this work yet. And, you know, I don't know that there's this, they keep talking about synergies. Oh, and we can offer private jets to our corporate clients. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure how that's better than for them when they it was just Delta private jets, which was never this huge business for them either. You know, so maybe somebody will finally crack that. You know, part of the challenge is you do these subscriptions that let you book empty legs for free often with some of these with private jet deals, because they can't sell. It's harder to sell individual seats on a private charter because of DOT rules. And so what you need is two different companies to do it. One that charters, you got a charter operator and a company selling the charter seat operating under different regulations and with DOT. And DOT itself is in a rulemaking process to revisit those and make them harder, like not easier. So anyway, it's a tough, and Wheels Up has done a little bit of that, but it's why everyone else has stayed away from selling individual seats on private charter flights for the most, in that space.
Yeah. And it's what makes JSX so interesting. I know you've written about them a lot. I've flown them a bunch. I'm just a massive fan of what they do. I think the arguments against them are pretty transparent in the motivations.
When they're talking candidly, they're trying, like the airline. So look, JSX is this, small carrier based out of Dallas that flies flies Embraer 135 and 145 regional jets, planes that might have 50 seats in them that they stick 30 seats in. And 30 is a magic number because since they're not going over 30, they can fly out of private airports, out of FBOs. And they run their own security, which is tight security. They use Evolve scanning machines. They run ID checks against government targeting databases. They swab your carry-on and scan your check bags. So they've got the security. But you show up at a private terminal 20 minutes before your flight. You get on the plane. It's a first-class seat. It's all first-class service with free Starlink internet, which is faster than anything in the sky, with complimentary drinks and longer flights. I mean, a 600-mile flight, for instance, you're going to get free snacks, free packaged meals. And people who are happy to be there, and the price point is pretty good. Often it's less than first class on a major airline for the similar route, and so you have this just overall better experience that you're in and out, and it's generally enjoyable. So naturally, American Airlines and Southwest are both based in Dallas. They really, really, really don't like it. United Airlines and JetBlue happen to really like it because they have ownership stakes in JSX. And the Airline Pilots Association, the biggest pilot union, hates it because the regulations that they operate under, they are exempt from the 65-year-old pilot retirement rules. They're exempt from the rules about the same number of minimum hours for a co-pilot. And so JSX has access to pilots in spite of a national pilot shortage, because based in Dallas, they go and hire the recent retirees of American and Southwest, right? And 90% of their flights return to base at night. So these people stay at their own home at night, and they schedule their flying when they want to fly around their golf game. And it's like they can attract pilots. It's less expensive. And so they have this great pipeline, and they airlines hate the competition and the union that has fought really hard for these restrictions that make it take longer and become more expensive to become a pilot, right? Don't like the idea of a workaround because this is what's one of the things really driving up pilot wages. So they, after intense lobbying, Department of Transportation announced that they were going to consider rules that would basically ban JSX from they're operating as a public charter and selling individual seats on the public charter using operating under Part 135 and selling under Part 380 and saying, look, you can't do that as potential rules. It's not actually clear that DOT can, without a change in law, could do it on its own. Airlines then went to the TSA and said, hey, TSA, you need to clamp down. TSA never had any problem with what JSX was doing until the lobbying. Now TSA has said, we're going to propose some changes, and we're not even going to tell the public what we're proposing, so you can't even comment because it's sensitive security information. right? So, you know, we'll see. So the big airlines are very effective at lobbying, right? They got $53 billion in direct taxpayer cash during the pandemic, $25 billion more in subsidized loans. They got tax breaks, you know, huge, huge lobbying. And, you know, the incumbents don't like competition.
Well, hopefully it all works out for us, the consumer, and they're able to continue operating. This has been awesome. We could do this for hours, but we're coming up on time. I always like ending with my Mount Rushmore segment. And in this case, the perfect one would be your top four first class point or mileage redemptions that you have that you've taken advantage of.
Yeah. So just first as a conceptually, okay, before getting like the best experiences, the loyalty programs, regardless of its airline, hotel, or any business in the world, has two fundamental components, right? There's, you know, recognition and reward. The reward is the value of your points and what you can get for them. The recognition is those elite benefits, taking care of your best customers better. It becomes really expensive to do it if you're really small. Coalition programs for that are great. But these large airlines, you know, have, you know, huge memberships and huge, you know, global reach and can deliver great benefits. Now, I mean, there's nothing that'll compare to on the benefits and experience side, what I was able to get when I was briefly a concierge key, because I happened to earn 7 million miles from a promotion around the holidays of December 2021 because of a mistake that American and MasterCard made. And so they gave me like that status. I mean, I was able to get on planes. I mean, this is like domestic flights. Didn't matter. You know, planes, my flight was canceled. They would put me on a plane that was sold out and they'd be willing to bump someone else. And nothing trumps that. But using the points for those amazing redemptions, I mean, gosh, going back, you know, forever, I would say, you know, I've done on a single trip, I decided to put together the first class products of the three big Gulf carriers. So I flew Emirates from Houston to Dubai to Bangkok on their A380 in first class to take the shower on board. They would even bring the $700 liquor to the business class bar to serve to me, so that I wasn't having to drink what the business class riffraff were drinking at the onboard bar, right? Before I went and like took my shower in the shower suite on board. And then from out of Bangkok, I booked Qatar Airways first class on their A380 and used their Al Safwa lounge in Doha, which is incredible because people say this lounge reminds them of a museum. And I say, in fact, they have pieces on loan in the lounge from the Museum of Islamic Art from the 11th and 12th century, like in the lounge. It's pretty good. And then on points flying Etihad, this is again the same trip from Abu Dhabi back to New York on their A380 in their first apartment, right? Separate seat from your bed. You take down the wall, you know, halfway in between, you know, two seats. And my wife and I are sleeping like in bed next to each other on the plane. And they have a shower on board too. And it's a dine anytime concept. And back then they had an onboard chef, which is a flight attendant that had actual restaurant experience. And so you just treat the menu as a list of ingredients and say, oh, you have these things on board. Like, so you can do these, you know, things for me. So you, okay, they had a smoked salmon dish in the snack menu. So therefore they can, you know, chop up smoked salmon in fresh scrambled eggs that they're going to make for me in the morning. And that's kind of the way that you do it. I mean, that's just like one trip. I've included five different Star Alliance airline first class airlines in a single award ticket that I've booked with United, where I actually managed to get United, you know, Lufthansa, ANA, and Asiana first class in one award. It was kind of like how can I piece that together? I mean, that was back when I was able to do Hong Kong to Ho Chi Minh City on United, right? And Lufthansa flew from Bangkok to Ho Chi Minh City and back in their, you know, first class on their 747. So you just, you know, piece all that stuff together for how much value I can get. But like, I've been doing all these things for, you know, forever. I've been able to fly. I've had Singapore Airlines suites where my wife and I were the only passengers in the cabin. So we had the whole suites cabin and the crew to ourselves. So we've had first class to ourselves in ANA's first class to Tokyo, in Thai's first class to Tokyo, among others. So gosh, you know, I've been so fortunate over the years. And the key to making use of the points is you know, pay attention to, because often the awards will come out in, you know, en masse, like, you know, a release all at once, and just book them speculatively and cancel if you can't use them. I would also say, you know, have some flexibility in your travel. Be, you know, have points in a variety of places that can move to different places based on who has the availability to book when you know where you want to go and when. And, you know, so if you have some flexibility, you can make some of these great awards work. And, you know, and not for that many points. Or 70,000 American Airlines miles, Qatar Airways, for their Q Suite business class. If you're two people, take, you know, you can a suite with for two. Take down the walls if you're a family of four and you're like four people in a business, you know, suite together. And it's fantastic. 70,000 miles to the Mideast or all the way to, you know, the Maldives or India. 75,000 if you're connecting to Africa, per person each way. But, you know, all doable because, look, they've got, you know, a lot of credit cards and big bonuses. And you watch out for offers with their, you know, Simply Miles card linked offers that you can stack with buying things on through their shopping portal. And then the miles, you know, add up pretty quick.
It's those are some unbelievable ones. And hopefully everybody gets a chance to do that at least once in their life and get some benefit out of it. Gary, this has been incredible. I like I said, I could do this all day long with you, and hopefully we'll get some time to have you back on down the road. But take some time. Plugs, where can everybody find you?
Oh, look, I'm viewfromthewing.com. And on the various social platforms at Gary Left.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it and look forward to talking to you soon.
Excellent. Outstanding. Good to talk to you.